So we've had the NHS 10-year plan, and we've also had last autumn's budget settlement, but will both be enough to improve and sustain the National Health Service into the future? And if not, what happens next? Now, Savid Javid, you'll remember, was Secretary of State for Health and Social Care in 2021 to 2022. And he's been on record as saying that even as we work hard to reform the NHS, we must now think of alternatives. Well, I'm pleased to say he's with me to explore all of that. Sajid stood down from being an MP in 2024, and he's now returned to his former career in investment banking. Welcome, Sajid. So it would be very useful to just kick off, Sajid, given your experience, about your assessment of where you think the NHS is at the moment and what's ahead, what we need to be thinking about.
I think the NHS is clearly in a hugely challenging position. It has been for many years. The pandemic has made it more acute. If you just look back to when it was founded back in 1948, the world has just changed dramatically. Our demographics are different, millions more people living to longer age, which is obviously great, but they need healthcare. The burden of disease has changed. There's lots more treatments and medical services and things that people rightly want. And the NHS has not been able to keep up with that demand. So I hesitate to call it a market, but at the end of the day, it is still a market. It might be a market for good, our healthcare, which everyone deserves. But you still need to have demand and supply meeting some kind of equilibrium and clearing. And what you're getting now, we've had for many years, is demand is massively outstripping supply. And the net effect of all of that is you get rationing. And that is why in Britain, especially compared to other similar countries in Europe and elsewhere, like Australia and Singapore, all countries, by the way, that have universal healthcare systems, something I passionately believe in, where we should all get high quality healthcare regardless of our income. But what you see in the UK is lots of queues for your GP, for your A&E, for diagnostics, for your surgery, queues at record levels. And that is all because the system simply just isn't working.
That's a very powerful argument. And we see the demographics, don't we? And we also see the access issues you mention. And we also see on the horizon further demographic problems and clearly the opportunities from tech that need to be afforded, hopefully. But if you look at the spending on the NHS compared to other countries, we're actually quite a low spender per capita. So one argument is, why not simply put up taxes to be able to afford Western European levels of healthcare? And if you look at our tax level, it is lower than Germany, Netherlands, France, Scandinavia.
I think the answer to that is, first of all, we do spend a huge amount on healthcare in terms of government spending, because in the UK, most healthcare spending is funded through the taxpayer. So it comes through general taxation, as you know, and your listeners will know, with one or two small exceptions like prescriptions for some people and things, the NHS doesn't ask you for any kind of payment for services. So there's no kind of contributory principle, if we call it that, or co-payment, which is something you have, by the way, in pretty much every other country that has universal healthcare, including the countries in Scandinavia that you just mentioned. And so we're relying on more or less your one major source of payment rather than having multiple sources of income to finance healthcare. And also as a proportion of overall government spending, I think back in 2000, it was something like 27% of day-to-day government spending, and now it's 45%. I heard Alan Milburn recently say it's the equivalent to the GDP of Portugal. I used to say it was equivalent to the GDP of Greece. So it's already a huge proportion of government spending. Everyone will know there's a lots of other demands on government spending, and some of them just as acute. Defense is an obvious example right now, education and others. So it's very hard in government. When you're the chancellor, and as I did have the health secretary, the education secretary, the defense secretary, all coming to you, especially during a spending round, you've got to trade off. You've got to find savings somewhere. Now, let's turn to your question, though, of tax, right? So you said, why not raise tax? And I think the challenge there is there's a multi-levels, but the two biggest things, I think that raising tax is not without its consequences on the wider economy. And so you might be taking a bigger share of a pie, but if that pie, the GDP of the country, is not doing as well as it would have done otherwise, you could get yourself into a very vicious circle. Also, as we're seeing with the current government, they are finding it very, very difficult to find ways to raise tax because we have other bills to pay that are non-negotiable. For example, the interest rate bill on government debt has gone, these are rough numbers, but for most of the decade 2010 to 2020, it was maximum, I think, would be like 25, 30 billion a year. Now it's like 100 billion pounds. So you're left with very few taxes that you could actually increase, that you could be certain that you're really going to get more revenue. Just to use a simple example, the top tax rate used to be 50p at one point. When the new government came in 2010, it's 50p. They quickly cut it to 45p, and the result was more revenue was raised, not less. So raising taxes can often have the opposite impact. And I just don't think there are many taxes the UK can raise that will lead to more revenue.
If you look at the kinds of other health systems that we like to compare ourselves with, and recently there was a very interesting policy exchange report that you wrote the foreword to. So they were looking carefully at social insurance models. Quite rightly, Germany came up and the Netherlands. But if you look at those two countries, firstly, their overall tax burden is higher, as we've just discussed. But the second issue is the share of the tax from income tax is also higher than here compared to other things. And they spend a whole lot more on other forms of taxes that we have far fewer of, such as mandatory employer-based taxes for social insurance. The differences between us and other countries with better health systems, we think, more funded, is this social insurance hike, which somebody has to pay. So why do we prefer this mandatory tax on employers and employees over income tax as a way of raising income?
Well, we do have a mix of both, right? You know, so there's only three taxes that raise most of the revenue: income tax, that's insurance, and VAT. And obviously, national insurance itself, as you refer to, there's the employee bit and the employer bit. Ultimately, all taxes, they're a tax on individuals and businesses. If you raise taxes, they will have a consequence on the wider economy, and people will make choices based on that. So, for example, we've seen rule changes, both by the previous government and the current government, has gone further on what's called the non-dom system. And whatever someone thinks, like, oh, that's right, that's wrong, the consequence you can't get away from is that we're already seeing, and you're going to see a lot more people that are mobile, they can afford to be leaving the UK, and you'll have a net impact of lower taxes coming in and an impact on your economy. Throughout my time in government, and I think this applies to the current government as well, because they haven't come out and said, look, we're going to raise taxes by 10-20% to fund the health service. Obviously, they have raised taxes. They've also made a promise not to touch these three big taxes I mentioned. In the British economy, the context is very important. You mentioned Germany. Germany doesn't have national debt at 100% of GDP. It's more like 30-35% of GDP. So the money we spend on interest, they could spend in effect somewhere else because they don't have that burden. But another reality, a hard reality, is in terms of electoral politics, you know, any party that goes out there and says, you know, vote for me and I'm going to put an extra 10p on your taxes or your income so we can fund the NHS, I think they would find that a very difficult policy to sell.
But if you're wanting to make healthcare in Britain better, and you're comparing Britain with Germany, Netherlands, France, or the rest of the social insurance type systems, as policy exchange did, there's no getting away from it. They spend a lot more and they have higher taxes to pay for it. So in a sense, assuming that if we move to a social insurance model a la Netherlands, that's the way forwards, if we're not prepared to pay for it, is quite a difficult question, isn't it?
If you take Scandinavian countries, I think even if you go beyond health, there's probably more government involvement in the provision of other services. So your government spending in general is higher. It's not just about health. It might be an infrastructure, for example, education, other places, but that is a long-term model that they have chosen. But as I say, context is just so important in this. You know, some of the Scandinavian, you tend to have, depends which country we're talking about, but you might only have two or three very big urban areas. So population is more concentrated, so easier to treat. If you're Norway, you've got a huge, massive sovereign wealth fund. So in the UK context, which is what matters to us, I don't think there's any evidence that you could raise substantially more money for healthcare, especially when you've got all these other demand, and you've got these non-negotiable. That's what I tend to refer to the payments on. You know, I gave the interest example, but also people would argue like defense and things like that are non-negotiable as well. So what you also find in all these other countries that you've mentioned and many others, and if we go even outside the European context, if you look at Japan, you look at Australia, you look at Singapore, for example, is that individuals are asked to make a contribution linked to the amount of healthcare that they're consuming, right? So even in the Scandinavian countries, I don't have the exact numbers at my fingertips, but I know in Norway and in Sweden and stuff, if you want to see a GP, you've got to pay a little bit. I don't know what it is, 20 euros, 25 euros, but you've got to pay a little bit, not to cover the cost of seeing the GP, but to almost act as a bit of like a rationing mechanism. And that can then potentially lead to better allocation of resources. I lived in Singapore for 3 years. I think their healthcare system is far, far better than our healthcare system. And part of the reason is that the way they allocate resources is they ask anyone that can afford it after an assessment of income to make a contribution to any medical procedure, diagnostic, and it can be a small contribution relative to their income, but they're asked to do that. We don't have anything like that. And I think if there's one thing missing from our system, is it's some kind of contributory mechanism so that those that can afford it, and I would emphasize that because clearly it, I don't believe as a point of principle it should apply to those who cannot, but there are plenty of people that are using the NHS that could afford to pay more, and it's not unreasonable to ask them to make some kind of contribution.
The literature that I've seen over the years shows that co-payments exist, they're quite widespread, but actually in terms of the overall cost of the health services in those countries, it's actually quite a small proportion. So you don't fund the health system at all through co-payments. They're usually just a marginal thing and introduced for the reasons you say there. It's a principle. And actually, we can debate that because there have been experiments, as you know, on the impact of co-payments. There's the immediate impact, which the Rand insurance experiment in the 70s and 80s looked at. And then there's the longer term impact that nobody looked at. And in other words, if you introduce a co-payment, 20 quid for the GP or whatever, and it makes people feel reluctant to go to the GP, they delay, then their condition gets worse, then it's more expensive. That study hasn't been done. So there is an immediate effect, but the longer term effect is not actually known. Plus the costs of collecting it, I guess, is the other thing to consider because it is an administrative cost, as you know. But leaving aside co-payments, which is an interesting issue you raise, can I just still go back to this last question about social insurance, which is if we cannot put up taxes, whether it's social insurance type taxes, national insurance, or general taxation to pay for healthcare, if we're reluctant to do it, if businesses are reluctant to do it for obvious reasons, what is the benefit then of a social insurance system over what we've got if both are going to cost the same?
One point we've already discussed, and I hear what you said about some different studies, but the evidence from those countries that have either, whether we call it socialist insurance or some kind of, you know, contribution, is that by and large, they have better outcomes than we do. And you might say, okay, but isn't that because they're just all spending much more on healthcare? But again, I don't have the full list here. I'm sure there'll be countries in that list that actually spend less than we do on healthcare, and they're still having better outcomes. But the other point I'd make is that I think it'd be wrong to look at the NHS challenge and say, look, it's all about funding. If only we had more money, it'd be much better. Now, I'm not saying, obviously, at the margin, if you get an extra 5 billion, 10 billion, 20 billion, can it improve, lead to more resources? It can. Fundamentally, the model is flawed, and that comes to supply as well, not just the how you finance things, but how we do things. We have a system that, beyond the funding, which is obviously crucial, is just not working at many levels, right? And so take primary care, right? So most people sort of gateway, as it were, to the NHS is through their GP. And the whole GP system is not fit for purpose. If you ask the average person, most of them would say the GPs are part of the NHS, but they work for the NHS. And as you know, they don't. But most GPs don't. They're independent partners, and they are running their businesses as they see it. And they have to have these contracts, and there's always a negotiation involved in that. If the NHS is going to pay for all GPs, not just their salaries, but for their offices, their rent, their insurance, because effectively the bill is being paid by the taxpayer, then why not actually properly integrate them into the NHS and have a much more integrated system where primary and secondary care work together. You talk about Scandinavian countries. Scandinavian countries, some of them at least tend to have, you know, I don't know what they call mega hospitals, fewer hospitals. You might have to travel to a bit, but it's actually just much better for you. And so there are reforms like that. And then the last on digitization and tech, we don't do it properly at all. I tried so hard with the studies on data save lives and the digitization work and the digitization of records. And it doesn't get the capital investment it really needs, which I think can lead to long-term gains. There's a company called Devoted Healthcare in the US, by doing Medicare, I think it is, for seniors in the US. And their approach, it's all virtual-first, AI-driven healthcare, primary care. And it is phenomenal in terms of outcomes. There's still lots of clinicians involved, but the productivity levels are far, far higher. We're nowhere near having this kind of digitization and change. And there's lots of reasons for that. And one of those is, you know, I've talked about having the right type of funding where you can invest now for longer term savings done properly. But also there's lots of vested interests in the NHS, lots of employer vested interests, trade union bodies that are far too militant and active in that way. In my opinion, some of them just not putting the interests of patients first and always thinking about themselves first, and very quite resistant to change. And if I may, just give you one quick example that always stuck with me. I went to a hospital when I was health secretary to see a fantastic new, effectively a robot that was doing prostate surgery. And it was up in Liverpool. The consultant that was operating it, the nurses were telling me that instead of doing three or four operations a day, they were doing five times as many a day. And instead of the patient having to stay one night, typically after an operation for recovery, the patient would go home straight away because the robot and the lasers on the robot are just far more accurate than humans. And I thought, what's not to like? And then when I sat down privately with the consultant, it was almost one-on-one, myself and just a couple other people. He said, look, the biggest problem we've got are the staff, the consultants, and they don't want to change the way they do this.
That's not an issue just for the NHS, as you can expect. It happens in the US, it happens in the Netherlands, it happens all over Europe, I guess. I think there are two things. The first thing is, if you look at our capital investment, and it's in the policy exchange report, actually, our per capita capital investment relative to selected OECD countries that are like us, it has been roughly around 40%. So we haven't invested in the capital needed for tech or indeed buildings, as you know. Back to your earlier point of our outcomes, sure, if you look at the outcomes of the NHS, some of them are better than the OECD average and some of them are less good, particularly we're worried about cancer, aren't we? But we, Health Foundation, funded an OECD study recently which looked at archetypes of health systems, private, Bismarckian social insurance, NHS-type systems and Nordic-type systems funded locally. And we looked at the performance systematically across all the available OECD data, which is the best comparative. And what it showed is that if you take these archetypes of health systems, the performance within each type was far greater than the difference in performance across. And what the OECD said, there's no one model that is the best type of model. And what they suggested was that what you do then, given all the challenges on us all for healthcare costs and demand and supply issues, as you said, is that you work with what you've got. So that's the best study that we have seen. That's not to say absolutely what you say is right, which is for sure there's masses of stuff that needs to change and all the issues you mentioned, resistance, diffusion of new technology. I'm not saying it all comes down to money, certainly not, but there's no nirvana here, I think. And that leads me on to my last question for you, Sarge, because I think it's quite important. You have been on record quite rightly as saying we've got to have a grown-up conversation about alternative models in future, which is non-political. And I totally agree with you there. How do you think we should best move forward, certainly in the next few years, to have that discussion?
Yeah, we do. And debate is constrained, to say the least. NHS, certainly political debate. And it reminds me of when I first arrived in the department in my first week when I was sitting down with officials. I remember them telling me about public attitudes and the official said, the first thing you need to do as Secretary of State is that the NHS is second to the monarchy, is the most admired institution in the UK. And then the second thing you need to know is that when you ask people, does the NHS work for you and your family? 72% of people say it's broken and it does not. So then he said, your job, Secretary of State, is to fix it without touching it. Because every time you announce you're going to make this change, this and that, there's so many voices that will come and try and knock you down and say, why are you doing things differently? Why is it this way? I'm afraid that amongst politicians, all parties, you have what I call narrative of adulation, where they're basically telling people what they think they want to hear, when everyone knows the system is broken. Everyone knows pretty much other rich world countries, whether in Europe or not, that are getting things more right than we are, if I put it like that. And politicians are reluctant to say anything by fear of just getting their head shot off. And also there's a lot of cynical scaremongering, there's fictitious conspiracies when you say something and things, especially in the age of social media. So your question though was, I mean, that's the diagnosis, like how do we get through that? It's not easy. And what I wanted was, I was really trying to encourage, just after I left the job and I was back on the backbenches, to try and get both the major political parties signed up to a royal commission to have something independent of day-to-day government. Everyone agrees there's a problem, get the great and the good to get together, look at international best practice and other things, and come up with the reforms that we need. I personally have felt that it's easier in a way for a Labour government to do that. I do think they're more trusted in general by the public on the NHS. And I won't get into the detail, but I did have a number of discussions trying to encourage that. Obviously, it didn't work. Because you get into the fever of an election and the election mode, and it's a few months away and everything comes about how you're different from the other lot. And then now we find ourselves in a situation where you have a government that has, obviously, it's got a huge majority, which can always help. You mentioned the 10-year plan earlier. There are some good things in the 10-year plan. I'm not saying that. Some really good, worthy things, but it's actually not that different from what I said and what my plans and Jeremy Hunt. It says, let's do more digitization, let's do more prevention. So, I mean, who's going to disagree with all that? But there's no radical reform. And the time to have done that would have been early on in a new government with a new mandate and make those changes. So I think we've missed the boat on that. I think the NHS, over the next few years, will just be more of the same. I think we'll plod along, gradually getting worse and worse in our outcomes, because whatever government does in terms of supply, the demand side isn't really being tackled. I mean, prevention, more preventative work could help with that. But I don't think the sort of radicalism that was needed has been grasped. And that's a shame.
You're saying you've a kind of cross-party royal commission, or did you say independent, great and good?
I think cross-party, but with people that are non-politicians as well. In fact, you know, my view would be it should be more of the latter, more sort of experts in the field. I think that's where we're going to end up, something like that. But you want without a crisis. So they tend to do these things, but we wait till everything's sort of fallen down a precipice, and then it's a bit too late, right? Now, clearly, we're not at that point where we're not in a great place, but with the NHS overall in terms of outcomes, but there is an opportunity to do something like that. And, you know, Royal Commission, it can take years, but I don't think that they need for it to take more than, let's say, a couple of years. Public would understand it, but it also requires politicians being more honest about the challenges the NHS is facing, not making them party political challenges. Because look, the good thing in our country, and this isn't true in so many other countries, is that there is a general consensus agreement on the principles of the NHS, what it's about, good quality healthcare for all, regardless of their income. And we should exploit that in a good way to say, okay, guys, we all agree on this, but how can we actually come together, come up with some sensible changes that we can all then sign up to?
Central to the questions that commission you think has got to be funding levels.
I think funding has to be part of the discussions. You can't get away from the resources.
I hope you found that very interesting, listening to the discussion with Sajid Javid. I do think these questions need looking at really carefully. And also, I think, as you heard, we also need a lot more facts into the picture, both on the performance of the National Health Service relative to other country systems, but also the funding levels and the taxation levels across different countries as well. So let's leave it there. Thank you very much to Sajid Javid for his insights today. Switching to a different topic, join us next month, where we're going to be turning to one iconic area of care that we should all be bothered about, and that's cancer care. And this is because there will be a cancer plan published in the autumn, as we hear. So until then, thanks very much to Sean and Leo at the Health Foundation for all their help as usual, and to Paddy and his team at Malt Productions. And it's goodbye until next time from me, Jennifer Dixon. Thank you.